Waiting for science and society to wake up is perilously slow and narrow in vision, unlike the man who spoke these words, Paul Stamets. He is a dedicated mycologist and botanist whose explorations are naturally leading him and helping to lead us to preserve our environment. Quite a visionary and researcher, we'll be discussing Paul's book, Mycelium Running. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Paul, welcome and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you, Robin.
So I love the visual of fungi blazing the trail to recovery. It's very Fantasia-esque.
Well, I love it too, and indeed that is the basis of life on this planet. 465 million years ago, we shared a common ancestry with fungi, and basically life hit the beach from the ocean, and then a group of organisms went overland and diverged from our proto-ancestors, and the fungi went underground. The overland organisms then, in order to protect themselves from moisture loss and from sunlight, they then encapsulated their nutrients and then produced juices, basically, that would digest food particles from within. And that basically gave rise to stomachs, so to speak. And the fungi externally produced the enzymes and acids, the digestive juices, that would externally digest plant and animal tissue, and in doing so would selectively absorb those nutrients that it required. Kind of to put it into perspective, it's a big surprise even to me, but in reading this and learning over now 30 years about how these fungal populations work, you know, around 250 million years ago, there was a great catastrophic event where an asteroid, some people think it was volcanoes in Siberia, it could have been both, but in any event, there was a huge catastrophic event, and at the border of the Permian and the Triassic periods, and the Earth became shrouded in dust. The Earth darkened essentially, and plants, which require light, of course, then were devastated, and so over 90% of the species on the planet became extinct, and this is well known in the fossil record, and then. The Earth was darkened for years. We don't know how long. It is totally speculative. But basically, fungi then inherited the Earth since they didn't require light. And there was all these debris fields and all this dead material around. They digested these nutrients. And the plants that associated with fungi and created symbiotic relationships, they could gain sugars and nutrients from the fungi in absence of light. And so that had a natural selective pressure on symbiosis of plants and fungi working together. Then as we march forward again to about 65 million years ago, as we most of us all know, there was another meteorite that hit the Earth. And again, the Earth became shrouded in darkness. And then another huge, massive extinction. And more than 90% of the species then became extinct. What's interesting, in between those periods of time, we now have mushrooms that are preserved in fossilized amber, and the oldest mushroom so far found is 100 million years old. It's got a cap, it's got a stem, it has gills. It would be what you and I would look at and say, that's a mushroom. But we were basically, 100 million years ago, we didn't even have our bipedal form. In fact, many scientists believe that we evolved from these small mole-like creatures that were able to live underground, and of course they also consume lots of fungi. So as we share more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom, and just this month in the Journal of Eukaryotic Biology, 23 scientists co-authored a paper, and in the paper they make the argument that fungi and animals belong to the same kingdom. Now, I would like to call the kingdom Mycoanimalia or something like that because it tells the story. They get an A-plus for the science. They get an F in terms of public relations. They called it the new kingdom, joining fungi and animals together, is called Opisthokonta. And I think it's a really poor choice of a name for a new kingdom. I would rather be in the kingdom of Mycoanimalia. But this also is something that physicians quickly recognize because antifungal medicines tend to be very toxic to humans and and other animals. But we gain many antibacterial antibiotics from fungi because we share this common ancestry, and many of the microbial pathogens, specifically bacteria, that infect mushrooms also infect humans. So Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, etc., these are the same parasites that also parasitize these fungi. And so the antibiotics that these fungi produce that prevent bacterial infection are highly useful for us in preventing bacterial infection. But if you have a fungal infection, as many of your listeners know, and especially AIDS patients know, that AIDS patients typically don't die directly from the virus, HIV. They die as a consequence of disease complexes, cancer, and fungal infections, and antifungal medicines are very, very toxic.
So the fungi actually have worked out a way to deal with them, though, it seems, yes?
Oh, indeed. And the largest organism in the world thus far identified is a mycelial mat, a mat of these thin-like cobwebby cells in eastern Oregon. It's over 2,200 acres in size. It's more than 2,400 years old. It's only one cell wall thick, meaning that it's a thin filament of chains of cells, and on the other side of that cell wall is all these hungry microbes, bacteria and protozoa that want to eat the mycelium. The fact that these mats can achieve these huge masses, the largest of any organism in the world, and yet only be one cell wall thick, whereas we have five or six skin wall cells now that protect us from infection. So it really shows that these organisms are highly evolved, and they are in constant biomolecular communication with their environment. And I believe, actually, these mycelial mats are sentient. They are indeed intelligent. And when we walk through these ecosystems, they're aware that we are there.
I have no doubt about that myself, and you really do have brilliant photos in your book of these fungal networks.
Yeah, the Mycelium Running is book number six for me. It is my connective book that connects agroforestry and permaculture and gardening and cleaning up toxic waste. And my premise is that habitats have immune systems just like people do, and mushrooms mitigate both. And so you can customize and articulate populations of mushrooms in your backyard that are specific to the health needs of your family, of your community, and that can be specific to the type of land that you live on. If there was a toxic waste spill or diesel or oil or dioxins or PCBs or pesticides, the work I've been doing over the past 20 years, we have found very, very good matches where these mycelial mats, which I think are smart organisms, are able to break down and detoxify a wide range of toxic waste. And in doing so, they dismantle these toxic molecules into elemental forms, and then after they are detoxified, they re-enter into the food chain. And we have seen that these fungi are the pioneer flagship species that come into catastrophic environments, where if the catastrophe is man-made or nature-made, it's these fungal populations that leap to the forefront. There's 1.5 to 2 million species of fungi in the kingdom, as presently understood, not including animals, of course. And of those 1.5 to 2 million species of fungi, about 10% are mushrooms. Now, mushrooms are fleshy fungi. Basically, you can see the reproductive structure without the aid of a microscope. So sometimes they're very, very small. But classically, they're the cap and stem variety that you see in the store, but oftentimes they are miniature in form. Of the 150,000 species of mushrooms that are estimated now in the kingdom of nearly 2 million species of fungi, we've only identified 14,000, which means our ignorance exceeds our knowledge by at least one order of magnitude, as we presently understand. Now, likely, as science marches forward, we will realize that, you know, we are truly Neanderthals with nuclear weapons. We are really, really ignorant about the complexity of nature. And we are all here today as an evolutionary success. So we should all cheer because we've made it this far. But we've only made it this far due to symbiosis. We do not live a part of our environment. We are a representation of the environment that has given us birth. And the huge problem with disease today that's caused by toxic compounds, whether those compounds are microbes or pollutants, is that we have increasing number of diseases, especially viruses, that are sweeping through the landscape. And the rule of nature is when an organism exceeds its carrying capacity of its environment, then diseases tend to proliferate. And it's kind of nature's immune system, and it knocks down the virulent populations that's out of control. We've seen this thousands and thousands of times with other animals. And humans are animals, and we are going down the same path. Now, we have these artificial controls, and we're supposedly smart. I think we give ourselves way too much credit in that department, frankly. But we have been able to support our burgeoning populations through transportation and agrotechnology and biomedical technology, et cetera. But nevertheless, ultimately, we face the same consequence of the activities of our being. And if we are not careful, especially very soon, then I think we're going to face a catastrophic collapse where the Earth will still spin on its axis and other organisms will be very happy that we're not around, but the Earth will still continue to survive even if we don't.
In your 30 years, have you been able to see new types of fungi or mushrooms that are appearing in your area, for instance?
That's an excellent, excellent question, Robin. Dr. Alexander Smith was my mentor. And he was a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan. He had written over 100 different monographs on mushrooms and wrote several different popular field guides. I met him, fortunately, I was around 20 years of age in Aspen, Colorado, where he and Helen had a small condominium. And I asked him this question as well. And he said that he saw, living in Aspen for about 50 years, when there were fires that were sweeping across the ski slopes in the forests, that he saw, and he knew this genus called Cortinarius. It's a mycorrhizal, meaning it has a growth in association with the roots of trees. It's a symbiotic fungus. And after the fire, he saw evolve, in the matter of about 5 or 6 years, a whole new species from another species that split off and divided into two. And so nature, these fungi respond very quickly to catastrophia. When there's a selective pressure on the genome, then these recessive gene expressions may be selected out favorably, and if it becomes stabilized, then you have a new species.
Well, I just think that would be such a fascinating realm of study because you could learn so much about what the actual shift was that caused it and, you know, perhaps the kind of medicine or what you could really develop out of the mushroom would be so telling for what's going on.
Well, indeed, and that's what my work with the BioShield program. For the past 3 years, I've been submitting samples to the U.S. Defense Department organized BioShield program, which is set up specifically to protect Americans from terrorist attack. And the number one concern of the U.S. Defense Department is bioterrorism. The number one concern of is virus, and the number one virus is smallpox. And since 1968, most of us, that's when the immunization stopped. So all of us born after 1968, you have no protection from smallpox. And even those of us who were immunized, it's highly questionable whether these weaponized forms of smallpox, they would overcome the immunization that we did receive. In the course of my work, I submitted hundreds of these samples of living mycelial extracts that were made in that we grow here in our laboratory. I have a very eclectic collection of mushrooms from the old growth forest, and I was delighted, and now I can talk about this. There actually is a U.S. Defense Department vetted press release that if people Google my last name, Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S, and POX, you'll see a press release that the U.S. Defense that the U.S. Defense Department approved. And in the course of doing the work, one of my species from the old-growth forest turned out to be highly effective against POX viruses. And over 200,000 samples were submitted to the BioShield program. We're the first natural product ever to show any significant antiviral activity. And of the 6 samples that were selected as being the most powerful and interesting by the BioShield program, 2 of them were my natural mushroom extracts, both of which came from this mushroom called agaricon. Agaricon's Latin name is Fomitopsis officinalis, and it was first described by Dioscorides in 65 AD as a treatment against consumption, later to be known as tuberculosis. There's over a 2,000-year history of use by humans of this mushroom. And when we boiled the mushrooms in hot water and submitted those extracts, which is the traditional Chinese method, they were not active. But the living mycelium produces a very potent antiviral. And since we had such strong activity, the BioShield program has now given us favored status. We've now entered into partnership with the National Center for Natural Products Research at the University of Mississippi, which is the federally funded natural products laboratory. It's the primary laboratory of the United States. I think they receive $150 million a year in research funds. They were instrumental in the discovery of Taxol. And they have been submitting samples of natural products to the BioShield program. My results were much better than anything that they've seen. And we've actually gone into partnership with them. And we are navigating now very quickly to find the active group of constituents. And I'm a natural products person. I think the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Of course.
That's a way of nature. But nevertheless, because of these patents that I've filed, and this is a, you know, very important to U.S. and international public health. And I want to say that, you know, I own this company, Fungi Perfecti, and I'm really grateful to our customer base that continues to buy things from us, because it's a great example of American entrepreneurialism, that an avant-garde environmentalist scientist living in Kamilche Point, Washington, with no government money, with no institutional money, with no grants, would spend $200,000 of his own money to find a potential cure for smallpox. And this is what the BioShield program is all about, is to think outside of the box, to come up with a novel treatment that is unexpected. I filed multiple patents now that are viewable on the patent homepage, both national as well as international. I formed a new company called Mycomedics, and Dr. John Norris, the former assistant director of the FDA, is now my business partner, and he founded the Bioterrorism Institute. He and a number of other individuals long ago recognized that, you know, you can control much easier the proliferation and transportation of nuclear weapons-grade material, but you can't control contagion like pox. And if there's 10 airplanes coming to the United States with Al-Qaeda-infected individuals that were infected with smallpox, or people coming over the borders, since they're so transparent in so many ways, if you had multiple vectors like that, it wouldn't be more than 3 or 4 months before there'd be a huge epidemic spreading across the landscape. And pox knows no borders, so it's just not the United States. It would be everywhere. So this is an urgent national need. And now, because this mushroom is exclusive in the old growth forest, now thought to be extinct or nearly extinct in Europe, and extremely rare in Asia because they've cut down all the trees, it requires these very, very large trees to grow. And the fact that Oregon and Washington State and British Columbia, parts of Northern California too, still has populations of this fungus means to me that we should save the old growth forest as a matter of national defense. And I think this is an argument that I'm sincere, I'm serious. It's based on scientific fact. Now, we will see as the in vitro work marches forward with the CDC, and that we have that planned, but we may have come up with a broad antiviral. We know it's effective against three pox viruses, vaccinia, cowpox, and variola. Variola is the smallpox virus. Vaccinia and cowpox infect cows, and they use also mouse pox also as a test. Vaccine came from the word vaccinia, and vaccinia is a cowpox virus. And milk maidens were observed in Europe during the great plagues of smallpox, that milk maidens who get these blisters on their hands from milking cows that are infected with cowpox, the medical practitioners noticed that those milk maidens were resistant to smallpox.
Yes.
And so then this is how this is how vaccinia and the treatments for immunization evolved. Now, it's a horrible part of American history, but we cannot forget history. The U.S. government and the British government were involved actively in bioterrorism against indigenous peoples. Unfortunately, sometimes at the signing of treaties, Indians were given smallpox-infected blankets. And the, however, indigenous First Peoples of North America did not have a history of raising cattle. So they were over 90% susceptible to smallpox. And the generals realized that they infect the population of these Indians, they wouldn't have to fight them. Number one, the Indians were fierce fighters, experts at guerrilla warfare. And one of my Indian friends told me that, that in their history, they were 8-1. They killed 8 Europeans for every single single Indian that they lost. And so the generals would realize that if they sent in these smallpox-infected individuals or blankets, that they could come in 6 months later and just walk through these villages, which were often located at strategically important military ports where the rivers would flow into the oceans. So we must not forget that. But those of us from European descent, since we have a history of exposure to cowpox, if we're exposed to smallpox, 30% of us will die. 30% of us will be sick but recover but horribly maimed. 30% of us will become blind. And 10% of us will survive without any symptoms. Unfortunately, with the best-case scenario, if the United States was vaccinated under emergency order, only 30% of Americans could realistically be vaccinated. 70% of us would not be, which then would mean that we need to have a preventive or a treatment, and there is no prevention or treatment for smallpox currently.
Well, Paul, there's a lot... There's a lot of dispute also about what goes on with the vaccines.
Absolutely.
That's a whole other topic.
It relates too, because if you're an HIV infected individual or otherwise immunocompromised and you take if you refuse to take a vaccine because of serious concerns, which are serious concerns, then you could become typhoid Marys. So there's a draconian decision tree that the U.S. government faces, that if there is a smallpox epidemic, you know, what populations are quarantined. You know, as bad as it sounds, if there's a nuclear explosion in Boston, it wouldn't shut down airplane travel between Seattle and San Francisco. A smallpox epidemic would. It would cause trillions of dollars worth of damage to our economy, and it trivializes the view that the old-growth forest should be viewed in terms of timber board feet of lumber. That is a myopic argument in terms of economics.
Certainly. And I'm wondering, you spoke earlier about these types of mushrooms in particular that need the old growth forest. What is it like for just across the board being able to cultivate various mushrooms that do have remedial physical immunizational properties?
There are basically several categories of mushrooms. We grow saprophytic mushrooms. These grow on dead organic matter, like plants or trees. Whenever a tree falls in the forest or a branch breaks off, these saprophytic fungi gobble them up. There are parasitic fungi that kill the trees, and the honey mushroom is one of them. But after it kills the tree, it can grow on the dead carcass of the tree, so they become saprophytes after they kill the tree. There are a whole big group of fungi called mycorrhizal, and these are symbiotic fungi which we cannot easily cultivate. They grow in association with the roots of plants, and they're symbiotic and they're codependent upon the auxins and gibberellic acids and the other plant sugars and hormones that are being secreted and utilized. Those are very difficult to grow, and the agaricon mushroom that I'm speaking of is one that we do cultivate. It is a saprophyte and in the old growth. It used to be thought to be a parasite, but we now have a lot more information that if it is a parasite, it's a pretty poor one because it grows on trees that are, 800 years of age and the trees are still healthy. The other group is called endophytic fungi, which are invade's a bad word for this. They coexist within the cells or along the cells that are arranged in the stems and leaves of plants and the grasses and trees, for instance. And they prevent insects from eating them, and they confer a host defense protection to the tree. The saprophytic fungi and the endophytic fungi we can grow easily, and the mycorrhizal fungi as a group are very difficult to grow And so what else is out there in the old growth forest? I think this is the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, of course. I'm sure it is. Do you recommend people planting layers of mushroom spores in their gardens?
Yeah. This is what my new book about is a companion cultivation of using mushroom allies to enhance the growth of vegetables. It releases nutrients. You don't need as many fertilizers or any fertilizers. It confers this host defense resistance to insects. And so you can create a plurality of species and a species mosaic that you can customize to your garden or to your land that can fortify the immune system of your ecosystem. And by doing so, you improve your own health. And my book has extensive chapters specifically on this.
Yes, and I heard one of your wonderful ideas the other day about working with putting spores and seeds in cardboard packaging.
Yeah, I have that's amazing. You're very well read. I have a patent that I filed that I hope is approved this next several months. And so I want to create a paradigm shift where that we can correct.
Let's put it this way. You are creating a paradigm shift.
We need to do a course correction. And I've sought patents because I want to steer the ship away from ecological disaster to something that is more sustainable, obviously. And the Life Box, I have a trademark, Thinking Outside of the Box. My idea is to revolutionize the packaging industry by infusing cardboard boxes, the corrugated cardboard boxes, with a populations of spores and then seeds. These can be garden vegetables. It can be an old growth forest in a box. It could be a garden in a box, whatever. And the box then, the delivery system for the box is already in place, UPS, FedEx, the post office. We all have too many cardboard boxes. What if all those cardboard boxes that were being delivered all over the world were infused with an ecosystem of seeds and spores that after the material is taken out of the box, whatever it's a book or Bible or Quran, whatever it is, then you could break the box down, add water, and a little oasis of life would spring up. I think it's a great idea.
It's brilliant, yes.
And there's
and it could be done by zip code, so you know what kind of plants.
Right. You could do it, you know, as we large companies now, you know, pick their orders, you know, out of the warehouse, you know, zip code prioritized. We already have the computer system set up. We could then help reestablish seeds or plants that are on the decline. You know, we wouldn't be using any GMO seeds or things like that, but we'd try to amplify and tilt the ecosystem back to healing itself with native plants. And this is something that I think is a great idea. I mean, if I could pitch it to Nike, and if Nike doesn't want to think out of the box, then I could sell it to Reebok, you know?
Right. I was thinking of bike companies because their boxes are so big.
Bike companies will give you a pretty good garden right out of the box, so to
right.
speak.
Just like those fungi, Paul Stamets runs in many, many connected directions. Fungi.com is where you can start finding out about some of that. Mycelium Running is his book. And for any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And on iTunes for podcasting, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.